Before I begin the lecture, I would like to thank the University of Michigan for choosing me as the recipient of the Wallenberg Medal for 2011. To be so honored is to be moved to contemplate on the greatness of soul that Wallenberg exemplified, and to be strengthened in the awareness that the world is in need of many Wallenbergs. I'm sorry I cannot be with you in person today, but our dedication to the cause of freedom binds us close together, and technological advancement has allowed me to see you and to speak to you as though we were in the same room. I'm grateful to all those who have made it possible. An old Burmese saying identifies the three happiest days in the life of a man. The first is the day he finishes his novitiate. All Burmese Buddhist boys are expected to be ordained as novices and to spend some time in a monastery at least once in their lifetime. The second one is his wedding day, and the third is the day on which he is released from jail. This saying raises many interesting questions about Burmese society, but for the purposes of this lecture, I will confine myself to the third day of happiness. I've often wondered whether it reflects a propensity in Burmese men to land themselves in trouble, or whether it indicates that Burmese authorities is inclined towards excessive use of their power to punish their subjects, or whether our ancestors, in their wisdom, were anticipating the events of today. Looking around at the colleagues and comrades closest to me, I cannot help but notice that there are few who have not spent some time in some form of detention as a result of their political activities. What is unquestionable is that our forebears believed that the restoration of freedom is one of the greatest joys man could experience. Freedom restored, how does it feel? I spent the major part of the last 20 years under house arrest. I've also spent short periods in a prison bungalow, in a military officer's quarter converted into detention headquarters, and in a prison guest house. The day I was placed under house arrest for the first time in July 1984, I found the situation curious. In one reading of a piece of paper, the detention order, my home had turned into a prison. Or had it? Surely it was up to me to decide what the answer would be. When I was taken to an isolated bungalow within the precincts of Insane Jail in 2003, I again felt a sense of curiosity. The bars on the windows, the clanging of the heavy iron door, it was all so like, and yet not quite like, all the prisons of which I had read and heard. Was it up to me to decide whether or not stone walls and iron bars constituted a prison? The time spent in the military officer's rest house, in which I was quartered later, also provided much food for thought. It was built in the grounds of an expansive army cantonment. Care had obviously been taken to make it comfortable, and I was treated like a guest whose movements had been restricted for inexplicable reasons. I was a prisoner, certainly, but need I feel imprisoned? In 2009, I was accused of breaking the terms of my detention order and removed from my house to the guest house at Insane Jail. This place was meant for visiting prison officers from other parts of the country, and there were neither barred windows nor clanging iron doors, and I wondered whether it should or should not be seen as different from the bungalow I had occupied 6 years back. Should I feel any different? Intellectual curiosity about the changing circumstances in which I found myself gave me a sense of detachment that made me feel, in my mind, that I was always free. I was thus a disappointment to those who eagerly asked me after my release from each round of detention how it felt to be free. "I don't feel any different," would be my honest but far from exciting answer. I may not have felt different, but freedom was certainly different from captivity, and one becomes aware of this difference from the moment of release. When I was told in 1995 that after 6 years under house arrest, I could once again look upon myself as a free agent, I was not quite sure what my first act should be. The telephone line had been cut for all those years. I had no family waiting to greet me outside the gate. I had no idea how to contact any of my friends or colleagues. Finally, I asked the departing security officers if they could let those members of my party who lived nearest to my house know that I had been released. That was a curious sensation, to be once again in a position to decide with whom I would make contact and in what way. It was a re-entering into human society. When we ask for the release of political prisoners, we are asking that they be readmitted to their rightful place in human society. That freedom of association, together with other freedoms of which they had been deprived, be restored to them. What is it about freedom that makes it a burning issue for all times? Give me freedom or give me death. Liberty, equality, fraternity. The ringing calls for freedom that have resonated across the ages and across racial and political and geographical divides stand evidence to man's yearning to be free. But why should this be so? Why is it that humans and animals too instinctively shy away from the threat of a shackled existence? It has been argued that it is impossible to attain a state of pure freedom as the extent to which living creatures can exercise their will freely is unavoidably circumscribed by their own circumstances. I do not propose to enter into discussion of free will here. My aim is simply to examine what freedom means to ordinary people outside the realm of philosophical speculation, particularly to those who have been engaged in the movement for democracy and human rights in Burma. The desire for freedom is closely related to resentment against perceived injustices. The uprising against the dictatorship of the military-backed Burma Socialist Program Party, BSPP, in 1988 was rooted in anger and dissatisfaction initially stirred up by the demonetization of banknotes in 1987. The economic stagnation into which the country had fallen under the BSPP administration had made it very hard for anybody to earn a decent income honestly. And when the public saw the savings they had managed to scrape together vanishing overnight, their outrage was dry tinder, waiting to become a raging conflagration. The necessary spark was provided in March 1988 when the crude handling by the authorities of a fracas that had taken place between students of the Rangoon Institute of Technology and local youths led to clashes between the police and students, two of whom were shot dead. This was the beginning of massive demonstrations that swept across the country as people from all walks of life poured out onto the streets to give vent to a sense of injury that had been rankling in their breasts throughout the years of helpless submission to an authoritarian power. The uprising of 1988 started out as a movement against repression and injustice. It was a demand for the removal of shackles. It was a call for redemption, a cry for freedom as escape from the restraints that cramped the quality of life. To be forced to submit unremittingly to the will of others is to be denied the right to exercise control over one's own life, to be deprived of the basic independence essential for the upholding of human dignity. Hundreds of thousands marched through the streets of all the major cities and towns, and even some of the bigger villages of Burma, roaring out our cause. At the beginning, that cause was not identified. There was just a conviction that it was something quite different from what authoritarianism had to offer. It was, ironically, three simple words used by the aging dictator Ne Win, chairman of the BSPP, in his last speech to the National Assembly that provided the first inkling of what would turn out to be the cause around which the Burmese public would rally. As Ne Win announced his resignation from the party, he declared that the people should choose between a one-party system or a multi-party system. There were many in Burma in 1988 who remembered that more than 20 years ago, there had been a multi-party system in the country, a multi-party democracy. They also remembered that in those far-off days, the continued survival in office of a government had depended on the votes of the people, and consequently, the administration had respected the public and made efforts to fulfill their demands. The young, whose participation was central to the movement, had neither experience nor memory of democratic governance, but they were quick to accept that our cause was democracy and, almost as a natural extension, human rights as well. However, these were to be the means towards a desired end. The goal of the movement for democracy in Burma was to lay the foundations for institutions that would make our nation a haven where people could feel comfortable in their own skins. Those who wish to denigrate the struggle for democracy in Burma have contended that our people barely understand anything about democracy, that we are neither fit for democratic institutions nor ready for the exercise of democratic rights, that the military rule in different guises under which we have had to live since 1962 was simply what we had deserved. We need to examine such accusations in the light of what our people expected to achieve through the democratic revolution. In October 1988, very soon after the founding of the National League for Democracy, I went around the country to try to discover what had moved our people to reject the only system of government they had ever known, and what we would need to do to realize the legitimate aspirations that the great majority of us shared. During a meeting with new party members from Zejo, a famous market in Mandalay, a young woman stood up and admitted that while she wholeheartedly supported the movement for democracy, she did not really know much about politics. I then asked her why she wanted democracy, and she explained that she had a small shop and she simply wished to go about her business freely and honestly without fear of undue interference from the authorities. And she was convinced that, given these basic freedoms, she would be able to do very well indeed for herself. It seemed to me that she had understood the most important thing about democracy, that it was not an end in itself, but the means towards achieving a particular kind of society, one that would incorporate guarantees of basic freedoms and fair play for its members. As I went across the country discussing democracy and human rights, I would come across, again and again, this coupling of freedom with fair play, with justice. Everybody wished for better health and education facilities, a sound economy, a more hopeful future for their children. However, and this I found most encouraging, the majority believed they could build better lives for themselves provided unreasonable restraints, particularly those imposed by corrupt and accountable officialdom, were removed. The young shopkeeper from Mandalay and others like her were expressing, in their own modest, non-academic way, views very similar to those of Professor Amartya Sen's ideas on development and freedom. Development requires the removal of major sources of unfreedom, poverty as well as tyranny, poor economic opportunities as well as systematic social deprivation, neglect of public facilities as well as intolerance or overactivity of repressive states. Again, Professor Sen, greater freedom enhances the ability of people to help themselves and also to influence the world. And these matters are central to the process of development. The people of Burma had made democracy their cause because they wanted the freedom to be able to help themselves. To engage in politics in post-1988 Burma was to start chapter 2 of the history of democracy in our country. The introduction was the movement for independence that had politicized the masses and woken them to the centricity of their role in the making of the nation. Chapter 1 constituted the first years of independence, when a parliamentary democracy had managed to survive and even to put out gallant shoots of social and economic progress, in spite of old wounds left by war and colonialism and new ones that had opened up with the eruption of the so-called multicolored insurgencies. Multicolored because there were the red and white mutually hostile communist forces, the Karen National Defense Organization, and the White Comrades, an organization headed by veterans of the patriotic Burmese forces that had joined the Allies towards the end of the war to defeat Japanese troops in the country. The struggling young democracy of post-independence was brought to a close by the military coup of 1962. Chapter 2 of the quest for democracy had to be started almost from scratch. From democracy to human rights is a natural transition. In 1988, very, very few people in Burma had heard of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It is evidence of the genius of the document that once its contents were made known to those who had hitherto been totally unaware of its existence, understanding and acceptance followed quickly. The very first paragraph of the preamble was a clear expression of their inarticulate longings, and it was a moving experience to realize suddenly what it was they had been lacking all their lives, and to be assured that this lack was recognized with understanding and sympathy by the great and powerful of the earth. Whereas recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. That is how the preamble begins. Freedom, justice, and peace. Were these not what they had been demanding all along? The preamble went on to declare that the highest aspiration of the common people was the advent of a world in which human beings shall enjoy freedom of speech and belief and freedom from fear and want. They were the common people. They were human beings. And yes, what they wanted most was to enjoy those freedoms that would enable them to live as dignified, worthy human beings. The different freedoms are connected and mutually strengthening. I have emphasized freedom from fear in our struggle because I see it as the master key that will open the door to other freedoms. Fear renders us dumb and passive. Fear paralyzes. If we are too frightened to speak out, we can do nothing to promote freedom of speech. If we are too frightened to challenge injustices, we will not be able to defend our right to freedom of belief, neither will we dare to ask for the rectification of the social and economic ills that make our lives a misery. Fear, anywhere, in any language, belittles, negates, and degrades. The Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore described the heaven of freedom as a place where the mind is without fear. Freeing ourselves from fear has been the unseen, crucial part of our struggle for democracy in Burma. It takes courage and commitment to achieve freedom and to uphold it. Where there are no laws and institutions to protect basic human rights, individuals have to fall back on their own will to practice and promote the freedoms in which they believe. The support of those who share their commitment helps them greatly in this endeavor. More than 10 years ago, I asked the students of an American university to use their liberty to promote ours. This message was picked up by peoples from across the world. We have been helped in our struggle. We have not been alone. Contact with free peoples enhances the sense of freedom. During the years under house arrest, such contact through the radio or through books helped to keep my mind free. To this day, whenever I receive a new book, I feel a stir of excitement in anticipation of the wider world into which I would be admitted through its pages. I can never be grateful enough to those who have helped me to feel I was part of the free world, even during those times when that world seemed as far away as the most distant stars. Even as the light of stars managed to reach us after long years, so the sympathy and solidarity of peoples, very often complete strangers, who care for our freedom as though it were their own, break through human and geographical barriers to give us solace and strength. An unshackled mind is the first step towards genuine freedom that is as liberating for others as for our own selves. If we are sensitive to our own need for freedom, but indifferent or even contemptuous of the same need in others, we devalue the concept of freedom. Liberty that is used to inflict pain and injustice on others is an aberration. It is no longer liberty. It degenerates into license. The ability to value the freedom of others as we value our own freedom is based on breadth of vision, a capacity for empathy, and a sense of responsibility. If freedom is to survive and flourish, we who believe in it must prove that it is a force that can be directed along positive channels by our dedication to a healthy balance between rights and responsibilities, by our ability to respect the hopes and aspirations of others as we would wish others to respect our own hopes and aspirations. I refer to Raoul Wallenberg as a great soul at the beginning of the lecture. It is difficult enough for the average man to value others as he values himself. But to value others more than one's own self, that is a rare phenomenon indeed. We in the Movement for Democracy in Burma have been admired and applauded for our efforts to gain freedom and justice for our people. But in the face of a Wallenberg, we feel humbled. We are struggling for our own people, our own country. What Wallenberg did was to sacrifice himself for peoples of a different country, a different race, a different religion. For him, the differences were much less significant than the ties of common humanity. He teaches us that the highest form of freedom is freedom from the narrowness of mind that ties us to prejudices and to hate, and makes us indifferent to the sufferings of those we perceive as different from ourselves. When I was released from house arrest last year, I explained that I did not feel any different because my mind had always been free. Now, almost a year on, let me tell you what it means to be free. It means that I can sit down and record this lecture. It means I can communicate with you. It means I can go out of my house at any time I please. It means I can talk to friends, confer with colleagues. It means I can work to take our country further along the road to democracy. Freedom means activity. Freedom means movement. Freedom means life. To deny means to deny life. That is why lovers of life cry out, "Give me freedom or give me death." And that is why I would like to conclude with this tribute to Raoul Wallenberg. Greater value has no man than this, that he lays down his life for the freedom of his fellow human beings.